This is Inside Asia, and I'm Steve Stein. This episode, I'm at the American Club Union Bar in Singapore with digital media and advertising sector veteran Ken Mandel. What you're about to hear is a really fascinating conversation about the past and the future of advertising that ends with a rare insight about the future of marketing. For those new to Inside Asia, Ken's been on our program before. Last time, we spoke from the offices of IBM's Watson Lab in Singapore's business district and discussed the future of social media in a time of artificial intelligence. Ken is founder in residence at Jam Ventures, a boutique accelerator that mentors and invests in Asian digital startups. Through his long years in Asia, he's been across all sides of the digital landscape. He's held Asia-wide leadership positions at Publicis, 141 Worldwide, XM Asia, Ogilvy & Mather, Yahoo, Salesforce.com, and Hootsuite. From these multiple vantage points, Ken has learned a thing or two about advertising, its adaptation to digital, and the many challenges that remain. I started off by asking him a broad question. Where are we now in advertising? How do we get here? And what most concerns him about the present state of affairs?
Well, I think going back, I mean, the agency structure was quite simple, right? You have these big agencies that did all this great work for people like Procter & Gamble, lots of TV, the era of TV where you just had, you know, lots of big ideas and all this, you know, big creative work being done for large multinational brands. And, you know, way back then when manufacturing started to get busier and there was transportation and the ability to connect factories to people, you needed agencies to really start pumping out branding to sell products and services.
And then the age of television, 50s and 60s, and all of a sudden here's this wonderful box that sits in everyone's living room, and you've got all eyeballs focused on four or five channels, so you had a captive audience in the day, right?
Yeah, there was very little fragmentation. There wasn't that many channels, but the channels reached an incredible amount of audience. And so it was a very simple business, and the stars of that business was, like, you know, if you look at the Mad Men TV program, it obviously was the creative director, the person with the ideas. You know, the engine of growth of an agency was, you know, what kind of idea you could bring to the table. And the people responsible for that were largely the creatives. But as advertising became more and more fragmented, of course, the sand started shifting. And if you fast forward to today, it's very, very different. Creative is still very important, but there's a lot of other players who come to the table to make great work.
Yeah, well, late 1990s, turn of the century, along comes the internet. And then along comes the big social media groups, Google, Yahoo, Facebook. And all of a sudden, chatter went out, and people said, it's time to go where the eyeballs are going, to follow the consumer, if you will. So up comes along these media platforms. Can you tell us a little bit about the birth of these media platforms?
Well, I think the media platforms, in terms of, are you referring more to the early days of internet portals, like the Yahoos of the world? And yeah, I mean, they started aggregating an incredible amount of eyeballs. So in a way, almost replacing television, because you had all these people coming to these portals. The difference was they brought metrics that television didn't have. There was a more, I guess, concrete way to see how many people were viewing certain pages and these metrics. But, you know, to be frank, these metrics, these were digital metrics that not everyone understood. I think the digital industry did a really bad job defining what ROI was in digital. So it didn't take off right away. You know, television was still about gross rating points, where media agencies can go to a large, you know, FMCG player and say, we're able to move these many boxes from your warehouse because we're going to do this big TV campaign through these GRPs, or gross rating points. And digital was struggling because nobody understood the ROI of digital, but they knew there was tons of data there, but no one actually could kind of make it work into a standard.
So here's the dark side of data. You know, data can give you insights and it can build up to support your business objectives. At the same time, it could be overwhelming to the point where you're not quite sure what there is to mine in there, and then how to use the data and how to redirect your message. And it does sound like, but all things being equal, increasingly marketing departments decided, I'm going to give a larger percentage of my annual ad spend to these media platforms and less to the agencies to do traditional advertising, is my impression. Is that correct?
That's what happened, but it took several years for that to shift. So the consumer was way ahead of the agencies and the brands. So what was happening was all the eyeballs were shifting to digital, but it took quite a few years for the spends to shift to digital. I mean, when I started in, you know, doing early digital, especially in Asia Pacific, the spends were like 1-2%. You know, when I founded the IAB,
what's the IAB?
Sorry, Interactive Advertising Bureau, which would do an, sort of an audit, or report of what is the percentage of total advertising that is digital. It was single digits. I mean, it was painful.
And what is it today?
Oh, it can be up to 30, 40, 50%, depending on the market, you know, even more.
And we're talking about billions of dollars flowing to the Facebooks and Googles of the world. And my understanding is that, you know, those are the primary platforms globally for advertisers who want to reach young, or not even young, all ages, all consumers, anybody who's on those platforms uses them daily as social media tools.
Yeah, I think Google and Facebook have, you know, they are different. I mean, Google is probably more utility-driven because, you know, it's your email, it's your search. You use Google for your daily life, where Facebook is super engaging, right? You have your social network, your friends, who's in town, who's not in town. Probably a little dopamine effect as well there because you have this sort of ability to sort of see who liked your posts and comments. So they're, you know, extremely engaging. But at the same time, they both have very solid, scalable advertising businesses because they were able to scale, and they were able to scale across billions of people.
Yeah, and this means, Ken, that basically they're following the eyeballs. If you look at the percentage of time people spend on Facebook or Google versus even television, you all of a sudden see a shift, and the thinking among the marketing organizations, the marketing leaders, and who are advertising, you know, annually at the rates of billions of dollars, are saying, "Well, we got to follow the eyeballs." So more money goes to these organizations, but those have had some deleterious effects, haven't they? There've been some organizations that have suffered. Media, for instance, traditional media, magazines, even television now is starting to feel the bite. What's the result of this, and does it mean that we're ultimately going to see the falling away of all those classic, you know, branded publications that were the place that we used to go and get our information and our entertainment?
I think publishing is definitely challenged right now. I mean, you know, what happened was publishers were slow to adopt digital. They were still, you know, very analog organizations, especially magazines, print, etc. But as they moved to digital, they realized that, one, there was a huge learning curve. Sales teams weren't necessarily aligned. You had, you know, two separate sales teams. You had a digital team selling digital advertising, and then you'd have like the print team, and that obviously was a transitionary period. But there's a lot of pain there because as they moved to digital, the amount of money they could make was actually decreasing. So by the time they kind of got their act together, you had these players like Google and Facebook hoovering up most of that actual spend because their targeting was so much better. I think it's really important to say it's not just eyeballs. We shifted from eyeballs to the ability to target the correct eyeball at the right time in the right place.
So in principle, it sounds like a good idea. Sounds like the right approach. Sounds like, you know, you get a better rate of return, you know, based on your ability to target those consumers, to call them to action, to purchase the product or service that you're selling.
It is, but what happened is they didn't get enough audience. You know, like Facebook probably today has over 2 billion, I don't know, but that's a huge audience that is all targetable. It's all segmentable. The publishers were never getting any audience of that size and without any of that targeting.
Yeah, for instance, Time Magazine. I mean, for a while it was a global publication, but you never knew who bought it. You might know from your subscriptions, but you wouldn't know anything about them. You wouldn't know if they picked up the newsstand, and you certainly wouldn't know what they were reading or whether or not they read the whole article, whether or not they even cared about it.
Well, and remember that these publishers got the programmatic bug. Everyone started to do programmatic advertising. And what that means is basically they were selling their advertising space on an exchange, the ability to have a buyer buy it for a certain price that they were willing to give, but they didn't really know who was buying it. And you know, this worked well for a lot of publishers in the beginning because they were able to sell a lot of that remnant inventory, so not the front page or the front website, but several pages in, they could still sell the display ad through programmatic.
So they were getting incremental revenue.
They were getting incremental revenue. It was a bit long tail in some cases, but it was a very automated sale. Didn't necessarily need a sales team to do it. But what happened was it was a race to the bottom, and still is a race to the bottom for many publishers.
Yeah. So in the meantime, Time was just sold to Mark Benioff of Salesforce.com. You had Bezos from Amazon who bought the Washington Post within the last year. So there still appears to be interest in traditional publishing and great publishing brands. What they plan to do with these publications, though, is a bit of a mystery, isn't it?
You know, when Jeff Bezos bought the Washington Post, I was really perplexed. I thought he had this big idea in his head that he was going to use technology to save publishing and to come up with all this clever stuff. And then I saw a very interesting interview with him not so long ago where none of that was true. He really bought it because he believed in the institution. He believed in the person who owned it and ran it and felt that it was an important thing for him to do. It almost felt like a charity case, which was maybe not what it was, but I think, you know, Benioff is in a similar position where these guys are thinking that these are important institutions and they want to preserve them. And ultimately, I guess billionaires, they always have certain things they collect. A lot of it has been football teams. Most billionaires have a football team. Now you have to have a magazine.
Yeah, well, there you go. So, I mean, they're clearly, I mean, whether they are preserved or not, or whether or not they become, you know, the profit motive fades and now they become more like think tanks or you know, repositories of clear-minded thinking. Who knows? But it does suggest to me that profit driver that once made media, traditional media, great is now fallen by the wayside. The other victims in this whole shift in digital advertising are the ad agencies themselves, as we started out discussing. What's their future? I mean, what's happening with ad agencies now that creative is less and less important? It's more kind of this this idea of using the media platforms to sell ads, and so there you don't have as much of the engagement that you once had with the advertising agents. What's their future look like?
I mean, that's the $64 million question, and you know, there's been a lot of pressure on agencies for a long time now. Unfortunately, the pressure will continue to increase. It's not going away, it's getting worse. In terms of their future, I think agencies have done, some of them have done a good job to diversify and keep themselves in the game. But the reality of the agency business is such that it doesn't scale very well. It's still very people-based, it's still very service-based. It's not a platform business, meaning that when you win more agency business, you hire more people. When you lose agency business, you unfortunately have to do something with the people and maybe even let them go, which is a huge cost of retraining because it's not that easy for agencies to hire talent as it used to be. You know, a lot of young millennials, they do not want to go work in an agency. You know, I realized when I made the shift from Ogilvy to Yahoo that a whole new group of people were suddenly available to me to hire that weren't available in the past, just because they never came onto my radar because they never wanted to work at an ad agency. And that was 2008. It's only gotten worse.
This is Steve Stein. My guest is Ken Mandel. He's a longtime digital advertising executive and founder in residence at Jam Ventures. When we come back after the break, Ken lays down some predictions on the future of digital advertising post Facebook and Google. Stay with us. This is Inside Asia. I've been speaking to Ken Mandel, a former Yahoo, Ogilvy, and Salesforce.com executive, among other things, and now CEO of his own shop, Jam Ventures. We've been talking about the past and the present of advertising. Now let's look to the future. Why? Because things are about to change. Advertising is big business and still growing. Not so long ago, companies chose television, newspapers, and radio as primary channels to advertise their wares. Where eyeballs roam, ad dollars follow. Today, nearly half of the $630 billion in global ad spend has gone digital, with Google and Facebook claiming the lion's share of revenue. Together, they generate $150 billion per year, feeding targeted ads to billions of digital addicts. That's where I started the second part of our conversation. Where will those eyeballs roam in the future? And where will the advertising dollars of tomorrow go?
Advertisers or brands or manufacturers don't want to have limited choices to put their money to work. Facebook and Google are a duopoly. I mean, they're a very strong duopoly. Of course they want, advertisers want choice, right? So they're very happy to find other platforms. But for the last few years, there hasn't been many other choices. Only now you're starting to see other potential players emerge. They're still nowhere near the scale of a Google or Facebook, but you know the biggest one is Amazon. You know, Amazon is not even trying to be in the advertising business, and they're the number three player in terms of spend that they're taking into their P&L. And I don't even think they're trying at this stage.
And explain why you feel ultimately that might be a better platform for advertisers and therefore a better way to capture consumer interest than the Googles and the Facebooks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the main thing is that Amazon is absolutely, their data is showing what people have either purchased in the past and might purchase in the future, or at least they've considered and signaled very strong intent. Amazon also has credit cards, meaning that if you don't, I don't think there's many people that have an Amazon account that haven't linked it to some sort of payment. So that means their ability to transact and actually make money. I mean, Apple's another interesting one because they also have credit cards if you think about iTunes and some of their services. But I think Amazon has much more powerful data than Facebook and Google put together.
So it's interesting because that data was the thing that drove advertisers initially from traditional channels where they didn't have the feedback to the Googles and the Facebooks. You're now talking about quality of data going to a different level. So whereas, and just to break it down, on a Facebook, you might know kind of what people, where they linger, what they look at, which news feeds, you know, how often they use it. You're talking about, you know, commercial data in terms of transactions. How many transactions, how many taxis, how many hotels, which locations, how often. And that is more precise indicator and therefore should be a draw for advertisers as they think about how they might appeal better to their consumers.
Yeah, I mean, I just want to backtrack a little bit about what, you know, when you ask me why Amazon. Amazon has data that actually shows purchases. So that means if I'm trying to sell something, what do I care about most? I care about if the consumer buys it. I don't really consider a GRP, which I mentioned earlier, or how about all this other alphabet soup, CPM, CPCs, so cost per click, cost per thousand.
These are all data points that are used in order to determine whether or not people are actually watching or paying attention to your ads, right?
Correct. They're measures of engagement. And they've been fairly important measures, but the most important measure would be cost per sale. So if you're Amazon and you can show that you've driven an actual purchase, you know, taken content, and from content you've gone to conversion, then that is the ultimate thing that any brand or manufacturer wants. They want to know if they've sold more goods. And so that is why the data that they have is so powerful. They can link that to content because, you know, the media business is not going to be about media. It's really ultimately about commerce. Did the media drive any sort of commercial conversion? And you know, you highlighted or mentioned maybe other players in this, you know, location, rides, whatever. You know, these O2O players, you know, like an Uber.
Explain O2O.
Oh, online to offline. The ability to take people online and drive them into a physical location.
A bricks and mortar building, a retail outlet.
Yeah. And so I think what's really important in any potential commercial advertising business is the frequency you have with the consumer. So if we backtrack, there's a huge amount of frequency on Facebook, but it doesn't necessarily lead to any commercial transactions. Why Facebook hasn't developed commerce, I don't know. You have to ask them. But they've been, you know, pretty much solely focused on advertising.
And then even regionally, you know, I mean, Amazon, you pointed out, is the biggest e-commerce player, but of course there's regional players. Gojek across Indonesia, it's one of the most prolific sites in order to order up motorbikes or taxi rides. So it's like the Uber of Indonesia plus everything else. You can even order massages online, I think, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, anything and everything you want, fast food, it can be brought to your doorstep. And then you've got Lazada, which is basically an Alibaba-backed business that's this across Southeast Asia, trying to build an e-commerce platform. You've got the Ubers and Airbnbs. Anybody within a e-commerce capability gathering that transactional data should be deemed valuable to advertisers, correct?
Yeah, I mean, the frequency of that data is where the magic happens. So if you look at Lazada, they bought Redmart. Why did they buy Redmart? Because you buy groceries a lot more frequently than you buy electronics or other things that Lazada was selling. So Redmart gives a lot more frequency in terms of the data that Lazada can collect.
So it wasn't because they wanted to get into the grocery delivery business, it's because they wanted more data that was more a higher touch point with the consumer on a day-to-day, hour-to-hour basis.
I personally believe that to be true. And I think, you know, you mentioned Gojek or you think of Grab or any of these ride-hailing businesses, it's the same. They're amalgamating different types of services because they get even more frequency across a broader spectrum, which means more data. And the ability to monetize that data is immense.
Ken, would you, I mean, here you've been in Asia for so long and been across so many countries. You know, do you believe that these trends in terms of, you know, advertisers shifting some of their spend towards the e-commerce, regional or local e-commerce sites will happen more readily in this part of the world than back in the U.S. or Europe? What would you suspect?
I think we haven't mentioned, you know, Lazada's parent, which is Alibaba. And if you look at China, that's already happened. I mean, advertisers are very, very focused on commerce. I mean, they're interlinked. I think advertising and commerce are almost the same thing in China, right? You don't do advertising. You don't drive traffic to a page that has no cash register there. Just like I wouldn't send you to a store where you can't pay. It's like, hey, Steve, you want to buy this? No, we don't have a cash register. So why send someone to a website or an app where they can't transact? Alibaba in China is the king of that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, look at Alipay too. They've also enabled the financial element of that purchase. And so I think in China, they are definitely the leader of the convergence of advertising and commerce, which I think will happen everywhere else in the world.
So once again, we have another example of a China-based business, a digital business, which may be showing the way. We've talked about WeChat in the past and other types of applications and capabilities. It's this integration between all these three and the data that's generated, which should be of great appeal to any advertiser out there who wants to get really granular about who their consumers are.
Yeah, I think these players, like e-commerce players and possibly even ride-hailing players, are the publishers of the future. They are platforms where consumers will spend a large amount of their time because of the utility that brings them. The trick is they actually have to walk a fine line between being a utility and a publisher.
Yeah.
Because you can't get in the way of someone's utility.
Yeah. And those agencies out there who are constantly reinventing themselves, whether or not they grab hold of this one and hitch their wagon to this new trend or not, it's yet to be seen, isn't it?
You know, there's a lot of smart people within agencies, and I think they'll figure out ways to be part of this ecosystem, but I don't know if they can do it in a sustainable way, in a scalable way, I should say. That's the trick. And also, will they get intermediated? I mean, agencies intermediate agencies. We talked earlier about independent agencies and how innovative they can be and how quickly they can move, but they can't do it at scale. And then, you know, you mentioned the irony of the fact that they get acquired, they become part of a bigger network, and then they kind of somehow lose that innovation.
Yeah. So it's all about keeping it fresh and keep mixing it up and always constantly trying to stay ahead of the game. Sounds like what this is all about.
Yeah, staying ahead of the game in a way that is sustainable, and that's not just out to win another award, but really is to move product or services for your client. At the end of the day, if the cash register does not ring, there's not a win.
Ken, fantastic. Thank you so much for taking time out. Let's watch this one closely. Thanks for joining.
Always a pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
This is Steve Stein, and you're listening to Inside Asia. You've just heard my conversation with Ken Mandel, founder and CEO of Jam Ventures, formerly of Publicis, Hootsuite, and Yahoo. And now we've arrived at the part of the program where I offer a few thoughts about the conversation you've just heard, the Asia Insider Minute. Here's my take on some of the key themes from my conversation with Ken. Observation number one, just having data is not enough. Back in the old days of advertising, we used to say that talk was cheap and that work speaks for itself. It didn't matter what you promised if the work was good. That was what mattered. The same is true of data. Data is cheap and there's lots of it. You have to know what to do with it, and that's something that comes across clearly in my conversation with Ken that might be a surprise to listeners. Facebook and Google have a lot of data, and they combine it with a platform that allows for ease of access as well as scalability. It's a story that advertisers around the world have bought into big time, and Google and Facebook have been the grand recipients. Has it been effective? Or in other words, because of digital ad targeting, have advertisers actually been able to sell more and win loyalty? Hard to say. What we do know is that large-scale digital ad platforms make it easier, and analytics, at least in theory, give marketers the data they need to justify the spend. There are signs, however, that advertisers are starting to fatigue and may even be rethinking their global digital ad strategies. As Ken points out, the conversation funnel, the Facebook and Google clicks that turn into actual purchases, is narrow. While those social networking and internet search platforms might be effective tools for shifting public opinion, or as we've talked about on this program, effective tools for shifting what people believe to be true, they do not necessarily translate into an O2O transaction. That's a key buzzword one needs to know because it's the holy grail of digital advertising. O2O means online to offline. That's what advertisers are really after. The key to moving someone out of the digital environment to the real world, from seeing a product in their iPhone to actually holding it in their hand. Ken tells us that not all data is created equally, and neither are online environments. How many times have you seen a product appear after a Google search and actually bought it? Maybe 10% of the time? Probably close to 0.001% for most. Now think about e-commerce sites. How many times has a product appeared during an Amazon search that then led you to make a purchase? A lot, right? On an e-commerce site, you're primed, you're there, you're in the shopping zone, for God's sake. Amazon knows what you want, what you browse, what you ponder, and what you purchase. The data goes deeper, and as pointed out at the outset of this Asia Insider Minute, the deeper the data, the better the outcome. It's a narrow example, but the takeaway is huge. Advertisers, if they haven't already been lulled into Google-like complacency, may be about to wake up to the power of advertising on sites geared for transactions, places where shoppers are at their buying best. The goalposts are fixed. Maybe now it's time to change out the players. Thanks for listening. Until next time, this is Steve Stein saying, coming from the outside on Inside Asia.